You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Man, I got the best top of the hour news in the business, right? This FPP radio news is just great. It's Daryl there at the Liberty Radio Network putting that together for you. I love it. All right, our next guest on the show today is Flint Leverett. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Flint Leverett. He's formerly a CIA analyst and a State Department official, and also was on the National Security Council. And his wife is Hillary Mann Leverett, and she was also with the State Department and the National Security Council. And they both left the Bush administration in protest over their Iraq and Iran policy back, oh, I don't know, say almost a decade ago now, or something like that. And they've got this great blog called Going to Tehran, and that's also the title of their book, Going to Tehran, Why America Must Accept the Islamic Republic of Iran. And now this most recent article, you can find it at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity and also at their blog, goingtotehran.com. It's called Obama at West Point, Doubling Down on a Failed Syria Policy. And now that I think about it, I was also supposed to say that Flint teaches international relations at Penn State. Welcome to the show, Flint. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Thanks. It's very good to be with you.
Very good to have you back on the show. That was supposed to be first. Currently, you're a professor of international relations at Penn State, and if I lived in Pennsylvania, I'd take your class.
I'd love to have you in my class.
That would be a lot of fun, although I'd probably have to duct tape my mouth shut before I came in the door, and nobody else would get to learn anything. All right, well, so let me ask you a bunch of things here. The Syria policy, you say you're criticizing Obama's speech here in this article with Hillary, and what he had to say about his Syria policy. You say he's doubling down on it. I say, what is his Syria policy that he's doubling down on?
His Syria policy has basically been his Syria policy since April 2011, about 3 weeks after unrest broke out in Syria. His policy has been to both from the United States and working with other countries to provide support to this basically externally created armed Syrian opposition, and to use these opposition elements to overthrow the government of President Bashar al-Assad. The motives for the policy were twofold. One, the administration was concerned in the early stages of the Arab Awakening that Iran was going to emerge as one of the big beneficiaries of this, and so you wanted to try and overthrow one of Iran's more important partners in the Arab world. And secondly, the administration just wanted to make a bigger point that up until that point, it was basically only pro-Western authoritarians who are willing to subordinate their country's foreign policies to the United States that were being overthrown or seriously challenged by the Arab Awakening. And the administration thought it would be nice to make a point that even governments like the Syrian government with a record of, let's call it, foreign policy independence, could also be brought down. Those were the two motives, and the policy was support externally this armed opposition. And, you know, they thought Assad was going to be a pushover and he was going to collapse. And anybody who knew anything about Syria would know, A, that wasn't correct, and B, would have some really serious questions about, even if you could pull that off, whether that was really a desirable state of affairs. But the administration didn't really seem to want to bother itself with those questions.
Mm. Well, you know, as far as they thought it would be easy, hell, you were on the National Security Council of the United States of America. That's an experience a lot of other people get to have, Flint. Are people who sit on the National Security Council, except for you, dumber than rocks or what? Because on this little bitty show, I mean, and I admit, I work hard on getting the email addresses of really great experts like you, but, you know, I don't have any special training or education in any of this stuff. I'm just doing my little thought experiments about, well, let's see, if these guys win, well, then what happens? Or, hey, let me ask you this. What's the ethno-tribal religious makeup of this country, and who's on whose side? Things like this. These are just obvious questions for anyone to ask, and, you know, I don't have a million staffers to ask. I got Eric Margulies, right? And I say, hey, Eric, who's who in Syria? And he goes, well, here's how it is, you know, a journalist who knows a thing or two about it. They don't have anybody who knows a thing or two about it up there?
Sure, they have people who know things, but the problem is the difference between you and a sitting president, whether it's a Republican or Democratic president, you start from a premise of, I want to know what's going on the ground, and then I'm going to think about what American policy should be on the basis of my understanding of on-the-ground reality.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, people who sit in the Oval Office, they have agendas. They don't start out wanting to know what's on the ground truth in Syria, what's on the ground reality across the Middle East as a whole. They basically have an agenda. And in the spring of 2011, the Obama administration's agenda was, we have to push back on Iran. We have to weaken Iran. We have to, you know, keep Iran from gaining through the rise of popularly elected and, you know, in many cases, Islamist governments in the Arab world. We have to stop that. So, the question is not being asked what's on the ground reality in Syria. The question that's being asked is, okay, if we want to get rid of Assad, what are our options for doing it?
Right. Okay,
and,
now,
and
so here's...
typically, you know, staff members kind of, you know, respond to the questions that come to them from higher up. It's kind of an exceptional staffer who will say, you know, Mr. President, Mr. Secretary, I'm sorry, but, you know, you're really asking the wrong question.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I've read enough Woodward and Clancy books where I kind of get how those sort of incentives work and what mice these deputies turn into when it comes to those higher ranks and everybody just trying to make their boss look good and all those weird incentives. Daniel Ellsberg's book is great at explaining the bureaucratic incentives as well, secrets.
Yeah.
He talks a lot about that. But but still, I mean, on this show for years and years and years, ever since I first heard of David Wurmser, I've asked, okay, but then what? I mean, if you really could get rid of the Baathists in Syria, then the most moderate that you could hope for on the other side would be the Muslim Brotherhood or something, right?
No,
or
that
worse.
Would be,
like,
that
this
would
is
be
the
by
game
far
that,
the
this
most
is the thought experiment
outcome.
We've been playing on this show for 10 years.
Yeah.
Man. You know?
You're absolutely right. The Muslim Brotherhood would be, in relative terms, by far the most moderate, plausible outcome.
And they seem to have been marginalized by all the crazies who really have come to the fore in the last couple of years of war.
And some of our friends, like the Saudis, worked very hard to make sure that the more radical groups got more weapons, got more money. I think, actually, you know, if you look at sentiment among Syrian Sunni Islamists, you know, they had already, even before all this started, over the previous decade, couple of decades, you know, I think they had basically, to a large extent, given up on the Muslim Brotherhood anyway, and they were turning toward more radical currents because Muslim Brotherhood was basically in exile.
Right.
And so they were turning to more radical currents who were closer to home. I remember even, you know, 10 years before all of this started, you know, having Syrian friends tell me that they could, back in 2003, they could take me to mosques in Aleppo where you could buy bin Laden tapes. And so, you know, Syrian Sunnis, the Islamists, were already getting more radicalized. And, you know, once you open this Pandora's box, you know, it was just going to become, you know, a really great expansion opportunity for Al-Qaeda. All of that was foreseeable. There were people, Hillary and me, but others too, who said, you know, from the beginning that this wasn't going to work, and here were some of the bad consequences that were going to flow from from trying.
Right.
But,
now, I'm sorry, I got to stop you right there. We got to go out to this break, but we'll be right back, everybody, with the great Flint Leverett, former CIA, State Department, National Security Council, now teaches international relations at Penn State, and wrote the book and keeps the blog, Going to Tehran. Back in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM and at ScottHorton.org. Noon to 3 weekdays here on LRN.FM. Oh, that's Eastern Times. All right, talking with Flint Leverett about Obama's speech and the continuation of the policy. Now, Flint, the way you characterize the policy here, I think you call it regime change, but when I talk with Ray McGovern, he says, no, it's the Israeli policy of just keep either side from winning and keep them fighting forever, but maybe they've even, the Israelis and the Americans have even scared themselves with what Syria might look like were Assad to actually fall. They just want to keep the thing going as a low-level conflict and I think empower al-Qaeda, really, but they see it as wearing both sides out, the old Andrew Sullivan flypaper thesis, as though there's some limited number of fighting-age Sunni males to be radicalized in such situations. Yeah. But anyway.
I've heard that argument that the policy really is to, you know, kind of let both sides fight it out and you don't really want either one to lose. I just say, you know, I think in some ways that could be a kind of fallback. I think pretty clearly the motive going in was we're going to knock off Assad. Mm-hmm. As that didn't materialize, you know, and people are kind of looking at the situation inside government, then, you know, when you're evaluating the situation, one of the assessments could be, well, okay, we haven't achieved our first objective, but maybe this isn't so bad because, you know, Iran is having to pour resources into supporting Assad, and, you know, some guys on the other side that we don't like are getting getting damaged, so we don't have to rush to end this thing. But then, as you say, with the rise of the jihadi elements in the opposition to such an extent, you know, even the administration has gotten concerned about this, and so. You know, but there's this inherent contradiction in the policy. You know, you can't just sort of sit there from Washington or even with some CIA officers out on the ground. You can't just, you know, sit there and decide with any measure of confidence or accuracy, oh, these are quote-unquote good or moderate oppositionists. They'll never turn the stuff that we give them against us or our friends. And these other guys here, they're bad, and so we won't give them stuff. I mean, this is all, you know, once you've given the stuff out, you know, it's done. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to be able to get it back, and you're not going to have any control over where it ends up.
When there are some stories that the CIA's been helping coordinate the whole thing the whole time, which if that's all really true, then it makes my question beside the point. But the way they put it is, well, the Saudis and the Qataris are funding them. And yeah, the Turks and the Jordanians help with the Free Syrian Army. And from time to time, we give them some non-lethal aid and all that. But that sounds to me like not very plausible deniability at all. Who's the hegemon here? We are. And at least, you know, again, with the thought experiments, if Obama told the Saudis, you know, back in 2011 or yesterday, hey, knock it off, they would knock it off, right? So this is really his operation to use the Saudis and the Qataris to fund the rebels there.
It is, absolutely. And I think you're right that, you know, for various reasons in terms of his own domestic politics here, you know, Obama made a calculation that at least initially he didn't want the United States to be directly providing military aid. But as you say, from early on, the CIA was working with others, the Turks, the Qataris, the Saudis, with others to help them sort out, supposedly, to whom they would give their support. And you're certainly right that you know, these other countries would not have been supporting the opposition, at least not to nearly the extent that they did, without a very clear indication from Washington that this was something that Washington wanted.
Yeah, so now, well, all right, never mind the accusations of high treason, because I don't want to sound like some birther, like I think Obama's actually an Islamist or whatever. He thinks he's too clever by half, using ISIS and using al-Nusra to get his dirty work done. But the thing is about it is it's not the Reagan years anymore, and we have since had a real war with these guys. They've had a war with us. They blew up our embassies. They tried to sink one of our battleships.
That's
they attacked
right.
us on September 11th and killed 3,000 people. And so I think it sort of kind of is high treason, but I guess my real point isn't what trouble Obama should be in for it. It's, again, back to the madness of the policy and the way it's all phrased. I mean, they acted all along like, you know, it's moderate rebels. In fact, I think the final straw was when Kerry testified to McCain last summer that, oh, no, the vast majority of the rebels are secular, moderate, America-loving types, and the whole room burst into laughter, and
yeah.
That was it. Now everybody admits that, okay, the rebels really are al-Qaeda guys. The only ones who are out of favor with al-Qaeda, not the Islamic Front and the Nusra Front, but the ISIS guys, is because they're too brutal. They're too Zarqawi-ite for Zawahiri's tastes anymore, and are a little bit out of control with all the suicide bombing and prisoner beheading. So really now, what moderates? Because I see this all day on Twitter, this dissonance where they admit that, you know, I mean, all the foreign policy expert types I follow
yeah.
on Twitter, we got to help the rebels. Obama's just not doing enough. And even his own Hillary Clinton and Petraeus and Dempsey and everyone say he should be doing more. But more to help who? Who are these moderates, Flint? Do they exist at all?
Yeah,
or they just mean that al-Nusra renamed itself the Islamic Front so that now it's okay
yeah.
to commit treason and give weapons to those who've sworn their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri?
You're exactly right, but I think there are two important points at play here. One is that, I mean, you're the notion of holding Obama accountable, it's politically impossible because there is not really any opposition to him on his Syria policy. If anything, to the extent the Republicans are critical of him, they're critical of him for not having bombed Syria last year. They're critical of him for not, like, giving tanks to the opposition, that sort of thing. And so they're not going to, you know, with, you know, a few, I think, very honorable exceptions like Senator Paul, you know, they're not going to really try and hold Obama accountable. The other point is that even as it has become known that, these jihadi guys are gaining prominence in the opposition, they're still for too long. And McCain is a perfect example of this. About a year ago, McCain actually went into Syria for about an hour and a half and met with some oppositionists. And even just on that, you know, kind of drive-by encounter, some of the guys that McCain ended up meeting with, you know, turned out to have some, you know, pretty unpleasant, deeds in their background, like targeting Shia religious pilgrims, things like that. And when McCain came back, and one reporter actually had the wherewithal to ask him, well, you know, if we give more support to the opposition, how do we know it's not going to go to bad guys when you couldn't even go to Syria for an hour and a half and meet with oppositionists and not, you know, be shaking hands with bad guys? And McCain didn't even try to defend it. He just said, literally, but at least they won't be working for Iran. You know, and I think it really shows what the mindset is, that, you know, you would rather give weapons to al-Qaeda if they'll get used against Iran, then, you know, actually look out for long-term U.S. interests.
Right. And at least he's honest at that point about it. By the way, one more thing about the Northern Storm Brigade there that he went, and according to the Daily Caller, according to Elizabeth Obagi, who set it up, she told the Daily Caller, so it was no accusation. It was his own group that said he wanted to have a sleepover with the Northern Storm Brigade at their little hideout. But his security guys pulled him out of there. But it turns out that if you just look up Northern Storm Brigade, the first thing that comes up is a Time magazine interview of them where they say, yeah, we're veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq. We went and fought the Americans in the Iraq War.
Yep.
So never mind kidnapping some Lebanese. They're hardly human at all to an American. But how about that? These guys killed American soldiers in Iraq, presumably.
That's right. But as Senator McCain himself said, at least they won't be working. They're not working for Iran. I mean, it's really a kind of bipartisan craziness.
Yeah, well, and you know what? That was the same thing that Michael Oren said as well, the former Israeli ambassador. He was outgoing Israeli ambassador to America at the time, too, said he was very clearly talking about al-Nusra and ISIS and saying that, you know, al-Qaeda, these bad guys compared to those bad guys, Hezbollah's backed by Iran. And so that's all that matters to us, whoever's anti-Hezbollah. Now, of course, this is only empowering Hezbollah and giving all of their guys years of experience fighting and all of these other things that are actually benefiting Hezbollah. That he would admit that. But it just seemed to me how, again, I guess back to sort of the cognitive dissonance of people knowing better but doing this anyway, where Iran really isn't an enemy of America. Iran's crime is declaring independence from America. But al-Qaeda attacked us on September 11th. These guys have sworn loyalty to Zawahiri. So how this could be debatable in any office in Langley or in Washington, D.C. is absolutely beyond me. I just cannot understand it. I can understand it, but it's just so outrageous that it seems like somebody would be, like Dempsey. You would think Dempsey would be against this, but he's critical of Obama for not doing enough for this. What?
You know, I think, actually, if you, you know, in the uniform military, I think the enthusiasm for providing more stuff for these guys in Syria is very much under control. But, you know, at the upper levels, you know, generals like other officials, you know, they, in many cases, they respond to the political signals and the political, what they perceive as the political incentives in front of them.
All right. Well, here's dumbest question of the day. Is there anything that can be done for a peaceful resolution to this conflict and not have 15 years civil war like Lebanon back when?
Yeah. If the United States and other external supporters of the opposition would get serious about first of all, I mean, not providing more weapons and dropping an insistence that you can't have any kind of political process, any effort at a settlement until Assad is gone, you know, and actually get serious about trying to broker some sort of settlement between elements of the opposition and the Syrian government headed by President Assad. You know, if the United States would do that, I think the chances for a peaceful settlement would definitely would be appreciably improved. It would still be a diplomatic challenge in a lot of ways, but you could at least begin to work on it in a serious way.
And by the way, I'm sorry I'm keeping you overtime here, Flint, but let me ask you one more thing here, going back to who's who in Syria. And this is something that you've addressed on the show before, and I think in this article you talk about it too. If I understand the demographics right, it's something like 70% Sunni Arabs are the population of Syria. And then the 30% are those ethnic and tribal groups, more or less. Obviously, there are some blurry lines here, but more or less, they're the ones who support the ruling coalition, the Shiites, the Alawites, and the various sects of Christians, and maybe some of the Kurds. I guess the Kurds supposedly are split 50-50 here.
Yeah, but, so it's about two-thirds of the population is Sunni Arab, but, you know, not all Sunni Arabs are Sunni Islamists. You know, there's a not trivial part of the Sunni Arab community which doesn't want to live under al-Qaeda, may not even be that enthusiastic about living under the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, you do have a significant portion of the Sunni Arab population that, like the Christians, like the non-Sunni Muslims in Syria, you know, they support the Assad government because it's a secular government that they think is the best plausible alternative to a Sunni Islamist order, which they don't want. And so Hillary and I have been contending since the beginning of this conflict that Assad has the support. If you do the math, you know, the non-Sunni Muslims, the Christians, the Sunnis who don't, non-Islamist Sunnis, let's call them, you know, it's well over half of Syrian society, and Assad has been able to retain that throughout this conflict. And I think, if anything, the popular support for the opposition is dropping as these jihadis gain ever more prominence.
Yeah, well, and they've they've been losing the battles too, forced out of Homs and all of that. All right, well, I'll let you go. I appreciate you staying on so long with us, and I sure hope people go and look at your great blog. It's Going to Tehran, Obama at West Point, doubling down on a failed Syria policy. Thanks very much for your time, Flint.
Thank you very much, Scott. Bye-bye.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org.